Generate is supporting my vision to improve the financial literacy of 100,000 Kiwis by sponsoring Keep the Change. Cheers, Generate. Head to generatekiwisaver.co.nz/change to find out more. Getting in the KiwiSaver fund that suits you and your situation is key to making sure you're maximising your investment. Generate are an award-winning KiwiSaver provider with a track record of long-term performance, and they can help you do exactly this. Their advisors can meet with you to talk about all your options when it comes to KiwiSaver to help you decide what's best for you. Too many people never get KiwiSaver advice, but not you. Go to generatekiwisaver.co.nz/change to book a no-obligation chat with a Generate advisor. A copy of the product disclosure statement is available at generatekiwisaver.co.nz. The issuer of the scheme is Generate Investment Management Limited. And of course, past performance does not guarantee future returns. Welcome back. You are listening to another episode of the Keep the Change podcast. And today we've got a very wise guest. I often say special, but both special and wise. So Professor Paul Spoonley, thank you for making the time.
Thank you, Luke.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting conversation today. Obviously, I gave you a ring recently and said, here's a number of things that I'm trying to go down the path with in terms of New Zealand and figure out for myself and where that could lead us.
Yes.
And it turns out you've probably been researching this stuff your entire life. So I thought, well, instead of trying to figure it out myself, I want to just ask you.
Yeah, good.
So do you want to start maybe with a little bit of background of what you've done over your career and what you've been up to recently, and then we can just go off into a thousand tangents.
Yes. Well, I'm an academic, Massey University, and I
Best
ended
university
up
in the country, is that right?
Yes.
I'm allowed to say that because I went there?
Yes, good on you. No, good university, Luke.
Yeah. Sorry, interrupted you
no,
already.
That's all right. No, Pro Vice Chancellor of the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. Recently been doing a job inside Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet, and also as an advisor to the police commissioner. So I essentially have headed up some major projects looking at New Zealand's demography, immigration in particular, and social change.
Okay. And that isn't just one government or the other in terms of colour. It's basically
everybody.
Yeah.
Everybody. And so under a previous national government, I was part of an advisory group to Bill English at the time, around evidence, and particularly evidence that would make a difference in terms of families in New Zealand.
Okay. And then as the governments change, they still lean on you to basically rebrief the next minister that comes in? Is that how that stuff works?
Yeah, it's not quite like that. Sometimes we get access to ministers, but what's frustrating is that we operate on a very short time frame in terms of politics in New Zealand, so a three-year cycle. Mm. And really, I'm thinking about the next 10, 20 or 30 years. And sometimes governments like evidence and sometimes they don't. But, of course, that electoral cycle is really quite counterproductive to thinking about issues, yeah, social or economic, over the longer term in New Zealand. I find it very, very frustrating.
I bet. So you're – because these are long-term issues, right? It's not
Absolutely.
Just like they'll be fixed in 3 years.
No.
Yeah.
No, indeed. And talking about demography, we know what New Zealand's going to look like pretty much in 10 years or 20 years' time.
Yeah.
So none of that is going to come as a surprise, but how do we talk about it now? How do we make decisions about it now? Really does matter.
So when you say demography, like what makes up demography?
Demography is the people and the shape of the population of New Zealand. So typically I would look at immigration because that's been huge in New Zealand, fertility, aging, regional differences, and look at that as a whole. So what's happening to New Zealand's population over a 5, 10, 15, 20-year period?
So when you get to the peak of academia, the correct pronunciation, you'll tell me, at university, is this sort of how it works? So you spend a lot of your life studying this stuff, you become an expert in this, and then you're doing that inside the university, but then the governments are leveraging off the universities to say, hey, could you come help us understand these things?
Well, quite a lot of academics work that way, but I was part of a team that sought external funding. So we had a program called Capturing the Diversity Dividend of New Zealand, which is really around economic, social and demographic change. And we got $6.5 million from MB to do that.
Yeah.
And that was a six-year project. So that was a big project for New Zealand. We were funded by MB again to look at the New Zealand's population shape in 2038. that was called Ngā Tangata Oho Mairangi. So I've been part of a series of projects which have been looking at these changes in New Zealand, which have been funded by government. And so we're part of the establishment that helps look at evidence. And then we provide that to governments, but whether governments use it or not is entirely over to them.
I see. And does their evidence come with recommendations as such, or then it's up to them to decide what they believe will be the best way forward?
Both of those.
Yeah.
And so I've written a number of cabinet papers. I wrote a cabinet paper with colleagues on social cohesion. I've written one on how we fund ongoing training for New Zealanders in terms of what's called CET, continuous education and training. So we do provide recommendations, and yeah, we certainly talk about it. And that's why I talk to people like you, Luke, because one of the things I will do is talk to government departments, big corporates. But I think it's really important that I talk more generally to New Zealanders. And so you might have seen in the Herald recently, I've done some op-eds, and I talk to the media, and I write non-academic articles to try and then communicate what we've learnt to a broader public.
Nice one. I suppose it's a little bit what I'm trying to do with some of the things that I've learnt through accounting and tax and money and finance and things like that. Yeah, and put them into language that everyday Kiwis can understand, because if it's not, I think, in that format, then it becomes very, it's too technical, I'll worry about that, you know, 3 years, 10 years.
And you've got an audience of three, none of whom is going to make much of a difference. No.
Yeah. Okay. So I guess maybe let's start there. What does New Zealand end up looking like based on the evidence that you've collected and the research that you've done?
Well, the demographic stuff is really, really interesting. So as we came out of the global financial crisis in 2013, we began to see some quite significant changes. The first is that we started to go sub-replacement fertility. So last year, our fertility rate, which is the number of births per woman, dropped to 1.56 births. Now, you need 2.1 to replace your existing population. So that means we're the number of births last year is not sufficient to replace our population. And that really began to change after 2013. We began to see a big spike in immigration after 2013, halted, of course, during COVID, but then took off again big time in 2023. The first of the baby boomers began to reach the age of 65 in 2010, but through this decade, we're going to see rapid aging, and we would talk about hyper-aging, which is where you see a population which is 20 or 30% aged over 65. And then there's the final bit is the regional differences. So we're forecasting that in 20 years' time, around 75% of New Zealand's population will live in the top half of the North Island, and Auckland will be home to 40% of all New Zealanders. So we're going to see growth largely driven by immigration in some cities, and particularly Auckland, and then we're going to see either stagnation or decline in a number of rural and regional centres.
Far out. There's a lot to unpack just there.
There is. And the key point is that whatever we thought of New Zealand in 2010 or 2000, by 2030, it's going to be a very different country.
Yeah, so, okay, I'm a very simple guy and a very high-level guy. So what I've heard there is that we're not having enough children to replace the people who are passing away, right?
Our fertility rate is not sufficient to replace our population. So you're putting it a little bit more directly than I would, but yes, it's probably true. Yeah,
I'm pretty rough around the edges, Paul. You'll pick up on that.
That's all right, Luke.
Okay, so that means that our population is shrinking. However, on the other hand, then we've got large levels of immigration, which are probably making up for some of that decrease.
Absolutely. So if we take 2023, our population grew at 2.8% annual growth through that year. The average for the OECD is 0.4%. So we're growing at seven times the average OECD for the OECD.
Wow.
And about 85, perhaps 90% of that growth comes from net migration gain. So we're growing, and Auckland's growing, but we're growing because of the very large number of immigrants that are coming to New Zealand.
So that means that a lot of Kiwis and New Zealand citizens and such, they're leaving.
They are leaving.
Yeah, but we're bringing in so many people that we're kind of covering that up a little bit.
We are covering that up. And that's an interesting point. So last year we had a net loss. So some New Zealanders will arrive and some will leave, but the net loss was 47,000. That's a lot of people going. Those are New Zealand citizens.
Yeah.
And then the 126,000 net gain actually includes that net loss of 47,000.
Wow.
So the numbers are huge. More than a quarter of a million people, New Zealanders and non-New Zealand citizens, arrived last year alone.
Far out. And we've only got, what, 5.3 million people.
Yeah.
I remember when I was a young fella, classic, saying that already, mate. When we went past 4 million and it was quite a big deal. Mm. When would that have been? Maybe I was back at school or something.
Would have been, I'm not sure when you were at school, Luke, it probably would have been. And one of the things, we thought that New Zealand would hit 5 million at around 2030. And we hit 5 million 2 years ago. So we're well ahead of the curve because of the numbers arriving via immigration.
So when you say we thought, is that like we thought as a nation or is that your research?
Our research, but also government. So Stats New Zealand do an excellent job in providing really hard data around all of the things I've talked about so far.
Yeah.
And they make projections, but our projections have been wrong.
Yeah.
We've been too conservative.
Because basically they've just been blown out of the water by people coming into the country.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I guess would some people just argue, well, this is just a blip, for instance, that this is just a bit of post-COVID and people want to come here and that'll all slow down and there'll be some regression to the mean or some terminology like that.
Yes.
Yeah.
And there might be truth in that. We don't know. So the two things we don't know is whether there's a rebound from COVID. Can I just point out something? I mean, we all think about COVID being a time when we didn't see much immigration. But we had over 200,000 people go through managed isolation in New Zealand. So that's a lot of people. Most of them were incoming, coming to the country. And the other thing was, when we went into lockdown, we had over 300,000 people here on temporary work and study visas. And the government in 2022 allowed those on temporary visas to apply to become permanent residents. And 220,000 applied. So the residency approvals, even though we didn't see a lot of people coming into the country, people that we approved to live here permanently was the highest it's ever been because of that blip through COVID.
Wow.
So yes, you're right. I mean, it might be that we're coming out of a post-COVID rebound and that we'll settle down. The second factor is we really don't know what the new government is going to do about the numbers and about the various visa categories and conditions.
Because each government can set their own immigration policies and sort of criteria, is that right?
Yes, it is. Although what we've seen is a lot of cross-government agreement. So both National and Labor have disagreed about some of the detail of the immigration policy settings, but actually the numbers between the previous John Key government and then the Jacinda Ardern government were not that different in terms of the numbers arriving and the net gains.
Yeah.
It did increase last year, but if you look at the 10-year trend, then it's a trend of having a lot of arrivals and high net migration gains. Probably the highest in the OECD, by the way, per head of population.
Do some of the other countries in the OECD look at what we're doing and kind of go, well, they're pushing the boundaries here and we're a little bit unaware to it as everyday Kiwis?
The funny thing about demography is that we often tend to default to immigration as being our population policy, whereas in fact, you know, fertility, aging, regional numbers all matter. So we need to put all of those things together.
Mm.
When it comes to immigration, the three countries in the OECD, there's 38 countries in the OECD, the three countries that are the most similar are Australia, Canada, New Zealand. And so we all share a common system, a point system. So you get allocated points for your educational qualifications, your job experience and what you will bring in terms of skills. And we all favour high-skill migrants. So around 60% of the people given approval to migrate here as permanent migrants will come under the skilled migrant category. So that's quite unusual. If you're talking about the US, for example, around two-thirds of the people approved to go to the US in any given year come under family reunification, not skilled migration, the H2 category. When you get into Europe, the Europeans don't do migration in the way we do, we being Australia, Canada, New Zealand.
Okay.
They have a very different model. If you go to Sweden, they get quite a few migrants, nearly all refugees. So Germany, ditto. So you have a different approach. And the other thing that is different is that you've got significant domestic political opposition to mass migration. And we don't have that.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Far out. You know a lot of stuff, eh? It's 14 minutes into this and I'm already mind blown. And my brain's going in like so many different directions. But so I guess going back to some of the first, how do you remember all these numbers? I guess one of our
That's my job.
Okay, good.
And the other thing is, I'm a bit like you are a numbers nerd in a different sense. I love numbers which tell us who we are and what we're doing.
Yeah. Mm. Okay, man, special. Okay, so people are getting older in New Zealand. We know that, right? Mm-hmm. I think you've got some stats that I've seen previously about the number of people that are turning over 65 plus compared to people that aren't.
Yep. So in the next 2 years, we'll see more people aged over 65 than 0 to 14-year-old. So normally when I was doing my demography last century, we would look at a population pyramid and the biggest cohorts would be at the bottom. And now the biggest cohorts will be in the older age groups, so the over 65s. So more people are becoming 65 because of the size of the baby boomer generation, which is those born between 1945 and 64, and we're living longer. Mm. So our life expectancy, we had about 2 years to life expectancy for every 10 years, and we keep seeing that going up. And the interesting thing about COVID was that of the 38 countries in the OECD, 35 countries saw a decline in life expectancy. In the US, the decline was almost 2 years. Three countries saw ongoing increases, and those were Finland, Taiwan, and New Zealand. And one of the things I don't think many people understand is that we had about 3,500 deaths from COVID during that crisis period. If we'd had the same per capita death rate as the USA, we would have seen almost 19,000 additional deaths. So COVID's been quite an interesting moment in terms of demographic history, but New Zealand is one of the few countries that has seen ongoing increases in life expectancy through that crisis.
I'm confused, mate. How does that happen? So
what we did is we went into lockdown and we adopted public health measures. And we did it quite early and we locked down. And of course, people have an issue with the nature of that lockdown. They're really concerned. But what we did was, in terms of that lockdown, we averted quite a few deaths. So people that would die from deaths that were related to influenza, for example, and other respiratory diseases, actually didn't die in the same numbers as we would normally expect. So we would expect somewhere around 32,000 deaths a year in New Zealand. And what we talked about through COVID was excess deaths. So the number of additional deaths that were caused by COVID. But New Zealand, because of its lockdown, actually saw a reduction in the number of deaths.
Wow.
So we still do not have, and I think I'm right here, we still do not have excess deaths that come from COVID-related deaths. And that's unusual.
So some people missed influenza missed death, basically dodged it.
Yes.
Because we were sort of protected in a form of lockdown, not just from COVID, but from all the other things that we'd normally die of.
Yep.
And then that, on average, increased how long we're going to live for.
Yes.
Far out.
Yes.
So then goes all your data again. You've got to start again, do you?
Well, I wrote a book in 21 called The New New Zealand.
Yeah.
And, of course, 21... really predated COVID. So I do need to go back and update it.
Yeah.
It's been a very interesting to look at what's happened around the world. Because we thought fertility would come back up as a result of COVID. And that's not been the case anywhere. So we've seen an ongoing decline in fertility.
Yeah.
And one of the interesting aspects is this impact on death rates.
Would a part of that, do you think, like my economics and finance brain goes to, well, things have become more expensive, cost of living on the other side of that, so people choosing to have less children? Because there's
different correlations. Absolutely. So the two factors that were in play prior to COVID were increasing credentials, particularly tertiary credentials for women, and their participation in the workforce. So in terms of paid work in 2024, it's 50-50 between men and women. So in the past, it would have been men dominating, but now it's 50-50. But the factor that's really kicked in the last 5 to 7 years is the cost of having children. And I think one of the things that millennials and Generation Z are playing off is, can I afford to have children? What's it going to do to my career? If, as you and I are doing, living in Auckland, can we afford not to have two-income family?
You know?
And so children become really quite a significant additional cost, and people are thinking, will it impact on my career? Can we afford children? And I think that's become a huge factor.
Yeah, even childcare and things like that that go along with it, right?
It's because, you're not kidding.
Yeah.
they had a thing called the baby calculator, which unfortunately has now gone offline, but it estimated that in both direct and indirect costs, to bring a child up to the age of 18 in New Zealand cost about $285,000.
Wow. And I guess a reminder for people, you're paying that $285,000 out of after-tax disposable income.
So,
could probably run some.
And of course, some of the indirect costs are foregone income because you've got to withdraw from the workforce. You might have to withdraw from the workforce. So there's a lot of things in play. And you know, I mean, our children, our adult children, they're having their own children, and the costs. I mean, the cost of housing has increased hugely, but everyday costs, and then the cost of just getting the car seats, childcare, you know, being off work because your child is sick. There's a lot of things that are wrapped up in that, and all of those have become more expensive.
So if we end up with a lot more people that are over the age of 65, obviously as soon as you turn 65 in New Zealand, you're allowed to I don't know what the terminology is, claim superannuation, but you get that, and that's not means tested or anything like that. So do you think that eventually we'll have to have that ugly conversation that we seem to keep pushing off and go, what is retirement? Not even just do we retire at 67 or super kicks in at 67, but like what is a retirement for the next generation maybe?
No, absolutely. And the Retirement Commissioner has brought out an excellent paper recently which looks at the options. And the thing she asks is that we have a bipartisan or political agreement that we actually need to put all of this on the table. You know, what is the age of superannuation eligibility? Should we keep it at 65? Should we means test it? Are there other things we should be doing? Should we be helping people in terms of long-term care? There are huge issues, and the cost, I'm a big fan of superannuation, but of course, one of the things we need to recognise is that as the population ages, that over 65, by the way, 65 is not the age of retirement.
No.
Increasingly, people are working well into their 70s. So we just need to bear that in mind. And should you be able to claim superannuation while you're still getting income, and you might want to set that at a particular level. We've got to have a talk about all of these elements, because one of the things going back to demography is what we call the dependency ratio. And the dependency ratio is the people in paid work compared to the people who are receiving superannuation.
And therefore not and not working?
And not working.
Okay.
And so that will, in my lifetime, will have gone from 4 to 1, 4 people in paid work to person receiving superannuation, to around 2 to 1. Wow. So we rely extensively on personal income tax in this country.
Hmm.
And when we think about something like superannuation, the question that I would ask is, how are we going to pay for it? Now, you you actually pay for my superannuation because it's a pay-as-you-go system, leaving aside the Cullen Fund to some extent.
Yeah.
So it's not just superannuation. It's the growing cost of healthcare because we've got this increasing population aged over 85. And once you get into a large over 85 population, things like dementia increase very significantly. So how do we look after the people with dementia? How do we provide for long-term care beds? Mm. We need another 12,000, by the way. How do we provide for those? So we shouldn't only think about superannuation, but we should think about the consequences of this changing population profile for a whole lot of things, and how do we afford them?
And then the fact that those people are all living a bit longer, right? Yes. So I'd imagine then they're going to then be eligible for superannuation for
a longer time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And so, you know, we need to think about that. We've had to put on the point at which people enter the get to the point where they are frail and need care, so they become dependent. We've had to put that on for 10 years. So the people who are reaching the age of 65 are certainly very healthy, and they're living longer, and they're living independent lives a lot longer. But you're right. I mean, the number of people who are over 85 and over 90 and over 100 is just going to grow.
Yeah. So are we not having those conversations that the retirement commissioner, for instance, is saying, hey, like, come on, we need to get around the table and figure this out as a collective as such? Is that just because it's too risky with the votes you'll lose, or what's
Yeah, I think that's part of it. All the political parties will have their focus groups. And I think my generation, the baby boomer generation, are really a bit of an anchor on some of this. So they will say, well, no, we've paid our taxes, we deserve superannuation, don't you dare change superannuation. Whereas your generation, Luke, I think are going to increasingly say, hang on a minute, it's me that's paying for this superannuation. And what happens, is it going to be available for me when I get there? Don't we need to have a conversation? So I think it's an intergenerational thing.
Yeah.
And we do need desperately to have the conversation. The other thing, of course, is to go back to a point I made earlier, and that is we don't tend to think about the long-term consequences of population change. So we should be preparing for that, and we should be having the conversations about policies. I mean, if you look at parts of New Zealand, it's what we would term hyper-aging, which is where we see 30 and possibly higher percentages, 30% or higher percentage of a region that will be aged over 65. Well, we've never experienced that before. So what are we going to do about funding facilities in that region? What are people, you know, are people going to be able to continue to live in that region? Will they get access to the sort of health services that they need in that particular region, in that particular locality?
I think somewhat of my age, and as I educated myself more, this is kind of the conclusion that I got to. So what I could see is, KiwiSaver becoming a necessity because maybe superannuation might not be there.
Yep.
So I probably want to be thinking about doing something for my retirement because I'm just not sure it's going to be the same as it is at the moment. Healthcare looks like it could get strained. Oh, do I really want to pay for this health insurance and these other forms of insurance? Not really, but if I'm going to need it, then I probably just going to have to suck it up so that I can take a bit of strain off the public system or not have to rely on it should I need to. And those sorts of things. And I think you keep walking down the path, or even education, and you see some of the statistics are going backwards and around literacy and whatnot. And I don't have a massive understanding of that, but I heard an economist say once that if you want to see the future of a country in 20 years, look at what we're doing in education today. And so you start to think far out, you've then got to stay educated yourself and not just rely on what's popping up in front of you. But all of those things, and then we start talking about infrastructure, for instance, and you kind of go, well, it feels like everyone at the moment is in agreement that shit's pretty broken out there and we need more of it, and there's potholes, and you're kind of going, where did all this just come from? But then you start to understand the population side as well, and you think, well, that's going to mean, like you said before, more beds in hospitals. And so all of these things are going to cost more, but then we're going to have less people in the workforce to be able to do it. So my simple accounting type brain goes to, there will be more taxes, there will be means testing, because how else do you do it? Like something, someone has to have a brave conversation at some stage and just go, nah, we're drawing a line in the sand and it is what it is. But it feels like it's inevitable to me that that's where it will end up.
Yes. And I agree with all of that, Luke. And I would say what tends to happen in New Zealand is we know it's coming. We don't do anything about it. I mean, think roads, think hospitals. And it's not one, it's not the last government or the one government before that. It goes back a long way. And we get to a point where it actually becomes a crisis.
Yeah.
You know, things not get a little broken, they get majorly broken. And suddenly you're having to think, well, what's the trade-off? What do I not pay for? And you can hear that at the moment. You can hear it. Should we be paying for school lunches? No, because we need it for something else over here, you know. So you get those trade-offs. And I just think that we really don't have those conversations, as you said, brave conversations. We don't have them soon enough. And, I mean, part of what I'm trying to do and part of why I'm trying to, you know, talking to you today, Luke, is thinking, well, look, guys, we need to think 10 years ahead. We need to think 20 years ahead. None of this is going to come as a surprise. Why don't we do something now? That's what frustrates me, really.
I wonder if it's because we're quite laid back as a country and as people, and so then we wait for a crisis to come before we're like, shit, we better do something. And then people like yourself are probably like, this is not really a surprise.
No, it's not a surprise. And I do think we go for the easy fixes.
Yeah.
So I've talked about the very high rates of immigration and the net migration gain. If you look at our GDP and our GDP per capita over the last 10 years, a lot of our GDP growth is directly related to immigration. And when we think about, you know, labour shortages, we tend to use immigrants, healthcare sector, elder care, IT, construction, just about think about any major sectors. And what we do is rely on what I would call cheap immigration. When I say that, I should explain it. Somebody else has paid for that surgeon or that engineer, paid for their education, paid for their experience. And we've gone to that country and we've said, come to New Zealand. So we've not had to pay for that person to be skilled and educated and to get that experience. But very often at the moment, it seems to me that we're relying on immigrants as a source of economic growth, GDP growth, filling labour shortages. And shouldn't we be thinking about how we do things in terms of educating and training New Zealanders, people who are here already? So I just worry that it's a relatively cheap and easy fix to get somebody in from another country to do the work here in New Zealand.
Mm. Because I guess it's probably faster, cheaper, easier, and we're looking for the easy way out, like you said before, right?
Yeah.
And I think, so at the moment, for instance, one of the reasons we're not in a deep recession or have really negative GDP data is because we're bringing in more people and then they are spending to get whiteware and those sorts of things, right? Where if you took all of them out because we didn't have this high level of immigration, we'd probably be looking at GDP data going, holy, are we in a depression?
Yeah, we are.
Yeah.
But remember the negative externalities of population growth. So you and I live in a city where the infrastructure, the transport infrastructure, hasn't even allowed for and responded to past population growth. And we're talking about very high current population growth. And I'm projecting future population growth. So we, over the next two decades, we're anticipating an additional 500,000 to 700,000 people in Auckland. So, you know, there's a whole lot of issues around those negative aspects or externalities of population growth that we need to factor in as well. So yes, we get a cheap and quick fix in terms of our labour market, but in terms of housing or roading, not so much.
Yeah, and I guess that brings it to a very tough part of New Zealand, which is housing. And we're not going to be able to build the homes, or I'd imagine we haven't been able to build the homes to keep up with the amount of people that we've been bringing in. So that'll be putting more strain on that whole sector and just that infrastructure.
Yes. And the paradox is that a significant part of the construction industry now relies on immigrant labour, at all levels, by the way, skilled through to unskilled. But of course, those immigrants need to live somewhere. So they're adding to the demand for housing. Mm-hmm. So at the very moment that they're building those additional houses that we need, they're also contributing to housing demand.
Yeah.
And so affordability and availability becomes a huge issue for a place like Auckland.
How do you think that people individually, if we just ignore for a second and accept that maybe we're not going to have those brave conversations as a nation, are there things that us individually with this knowledge we could be doing a little bit better to prepare ourselves for where we're heading?
Well, it's an interesting conversation. So in recent weeks, we've had the fertility stats. And I'm invited on to various media outlets to talk about those. And the interesting thing is that they assume that some sort of fix, that you can reverse fertility decline. Well, you can't. There have been some short-term fixes in particular countries. Sweden, for example, has invested a lot in trying to reduce the cost of childcare, having children, coming out of the workforce for a particular period. And yes, they've had a minor short-term impact upon fertility, but it really hasn't worked. And by the way, I mentioned 1.56 births per woman. Korea's way down there. Singapore's way lower than we are at the moment. China's lower than we are at the moment. So we're about middle of the pack, to be honest, in terms of that fertility. And I just think the assumption is that somehow you can fix fertility decline. I don't think you can. I have not seen any evidence anywhere around the world which changes it. And I'll use the example of Hungary because I used it in the media and it attracted a bit of interest. So Hungary in 2019 said if you have four or more kids, you don't pay any income tax.
Wow. Okay.
Well, it hasn't made any. Hasn't
oh, really?
Hasn't changed it. Hasn't changed it. The people that were going to have four children are going to have four children, you know. But, you know, others who are choosing not to have children or to have one and done, it hasn't really made any difference there. So, I mean, these are collective and common issues that we all encounter. They're all going to impact upon our lives. And so, yes, individuals can think about them and will make their own decisions, but it's quite difficult to answer your question about whether or not there are things that we should be doing individually.
Because I guess the thing that I sometimes spitball in my head is, okay, say you, we voluntarily contribute 3% to KiwiSaver in New Zealand. If we can get youngsters on that path earlier, maybe that becomes the road to means testing or saying, hey, well, now you don't get the superannuation and we slowly phase it out with people, you know, saving. But then you look at Australia and people are contributing 12%. And so you kind of think, well, they must know something that we don't.
And Australia has done aging much better than New Zealand. They have a manifesto. I can't think what it's called, but a manifesto around what you should expect as a population ages. So your rights, but also your responsibilities. And you said 3%. You see, and I don't. I mean, you can. It can be up to 8%.
Yes.
And why aren't we doing 8%, you know, as a rule? And then I look at what's happened in the last couple of years and I see a lot of young people calling on their KiwiSaver funds in order to purchase housing.
Yeah.
And I think, oh, dear. I mean, you know.
Interrupt compounding.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah. One of the number one rules of investing is don't interrupt compounding. And we're like, right, now you've got a bit in there, you can take it out for a house.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. That seems, and you'll probably know better than I, but that seems to be counterproductive.
Yeah.
We're not getting the savings right. And how do we help people into housing? Mm. You know, it seems to me there are really competing and very powerful contradictory pressures on people at the moment.
Yeah, I guess so. If I keep spitballing as to where those things lead, and so I think, okay, well, if I up my own KiwiSaver or invest for the future because I want to protect myself into my retirement and don't want to rely on super and things like that, and if I can save some money for healthcare should I need that or pay for insurance and whatnot, does that, the risk of actually doing that and getting oneself into a better position is the people that then don't do that, or because I read things like KiwiSaver is a scam and it's a government Ponzi, and you know you want to stay out of that and all these things, and I kind of go, okay. So there's a fair bit of distrust with it, I think, as well. But if you look after yourself and you get yourself to that position, does all that do a little piece of that is actually just drive more inequality as well, and then division, because all of a sudden Luke's going, well, I got $1 million in my KiwiSaver and things are pretty good for me, and to be fair, if you're still going to pay me my superannuation, well, happy days, maybe I will have that too. And I had a health issue, but I could get straight into the private health system because I could afford it, and people will go, well, you know, you shouldn't get that, and then we'll just end up doing the same thing where you look back at or whoever is saying that and just kind of go, well, no, I paid my taxes the whole way through, or I've saved my KiwiSaver. And then we just end up widening the gap between what we now call the haves and the have-yachts and the have-nots. It seems the way it's going. Yeah.
And there are two things in response to that. I mean, if you look at household expenditure and income, you've got to say that there is a whole significant chunk of New Zealanders who can barely afford lunches or meals or the rent, much less saving. And so are we going to put them at significant disadvantage because of, you know, we're expecting people to save. And if you haven't saved, then what's going to happen to you? But the other side of that is, look, I'm not gonna put my money into KiwiSaver, but I'm going to invest it into property.
Yeah.
So I don't have the $1 million in the bank. But I've got more than $1 million in capital in terms of property ownership, but I qualify for superannuation. You know, how do you balance all of that out? I mean, the fact that we don't have a capital gains tax in New Zealand, I think personally, is a lost opportunity. We need to have those conversations about, you know, how you accumulate wealth, what's equitable, how do we make sure that everybody has a decent standard of living and we don't leave people behind. You know, these are big, complex issues, and unfortunately they get very quickly polarizing.
Yeah.
People tend to split out. So if we go back to the superannuation question, should we have universal eligibility at age 65? I think we've got to have a conversation about that. But it gets political very quickly and you tend to talk past one another.
Yeah, and I think it becomes very political, and then therefore sort of, you know, what side you align to or have for so long and things like that, right? And then it just goes, all right, let's just
park it again. Yeah. Again, yeah. We'll park it, yeah.
Yeah, and we'll wait for the crisis to come. And
I honestly don't think we can park a lot of these issues. I think these are huge issues that we need to address now.
Have you, you know a lot about the different generations, but come across the literature around the fourth turning and seen any of that?
Yeah, I do. And one of the things we've looked at is the very different experiences and financial experiences of the different generations. So I'm not sure whether you're aware, but in New Zealand, the wealth gap between the over 65s and under 35s has doubled in the last decade or so.
Wow.
And of course, and my kids hate this, but, you know, when I bought my first house, it was double my annual income. And now we've got a difference of, you know, the average household income. The average house price is 9 times the average household income. And that's just averaging it out. So in addition to that, we've loaded up younger generations with debt. So, you know, a whole lot of the financial and wealth aspects of New Zealand have, in generational terms, been widening really rapidly. And at some point, we really do need to understand what that means. And we need to understand what the possibilities and the options are. And I'm expecting your generation, you know, I, as a baby boomer, I really want to stand back from this because it's not my future, really.
Yeah.
It's my kids and my grandkids' future. And I really would look to your generation, Luke, to take a lead on some of that conversation.
Yeah, I think that's what the fourth turning is loosely about, is the millennials ending up being the generation that then kind of lead the righto. Okay,
We've got to do something different.
We've been kidding ourselves. Yeah.
Fascinating
though. And I guess the longer we leave these things, then we lead the next generations coming through to maybe grow up with a mindset of like, well, I'll never own a home. Well, this isn't a country for me because look at where it's going. And I actually read that this week where someone left a comment on my Instagram and said, you know, if I want to do the best by my daughter, my solution and conclusion was to take her out of New Zealand. Why should I have to pay for all this mess? I didn't create it and whatnot. No. And like, I kind of have the mindset individually, specifically at the moment, and hey, you know, these things could change, but I hope not, that I pick New Zealand as my country and I'm still like, well, I'm going to stay here and fight as such. So then I've got to figure out, how do I get myself into a position where I've got enough to give back to other people and whatnot, because that's what I've learnt from. And then I think it's a good place to get where you can then give, and whether that be through education or whatever ways that you choose to. But I think a lot of people wouldn't be like that, and they would just think, well, you know what, with all of this information, it probably leads you to the conclusion of maybe Australia is the place to go, or wherever. Yes. And I think that's a big issue in itself, right?
It is. And about half of the people, you know, we talked about the 47,000 net loss, about half of them are going to Australia. Can I just, I mean, we're getting into a sort of quite deep and dark place. But can I just talk about the other options? I mean, New Zealand is quite a small country internationally, and we've proven time and again that we can actually change how we do things in a way that is actually respectful. So so Peter Gluckman and I have been recently looking at social cohesion in New Zealand. And in the early phases of COVID, we had really high social cohesion, amongst the highest in the world. And of course, once you got to the parliamentary occupation, some of that cohesion had disappeared. And now we look back and we tend to forget, and we tend to sort of blame and to complain. But we actually do, when it matters, we do make significant changes. And you just need to look at recent decades to see that playing out. We don't have the level of opposition and lack of trust and polarization that you see in other countries. We certainly have it.
Yeah.
I don't want to dismiss it, but I mean, all you need to do is look at the US and think, wow. And the Edelman Trust Barometer, which came out last year, which looked at 40 countries, and you know, they picked countries like Sweden and the USA and South Africa and Spain, and said the level of polarization, the level of political distrust there is now becoming a major issue. And New Zealand was at the other end of the spectrum. So I think we need to hold on to some of that. We are a relatively small country. We are adaptable. We do tend to work together when it matters. Mm. And I'm hoping that we will continue to do that, and particularly around some of the challenges we've highlighted today.
Yeah, I use a couple of examples, Paul, that I think are good to remember, and that it's not great when we have a natural disaster, but that's when I think everyone goes, I don't care who you vote for, whatever, I'm going to knock on your door and I'm going to help you out. And that's who we are as a country. Yeah. That's what a Kiwi is. And, you know, I went to a number of Warriors games last year. And you don't walk around in the stands and go like, hey, mate, who did you vote for at the last election? No. Or like, why are you voting for a capital gains tax? It's like, do you reckon the Warriors are going to win? We hate this other team. Let's be them. And you're there and you're part of it. And I think it's really important from a sporting angle at the moment that we have things like that that people can go to, because I think they forget about all of those levels of division and things like that. And I'm not saying we should hide from some of the issues we have as a country, but you realise that Kiwis actually like to get around each other and support each other and go, right, we're supporting the All Blacks today. And you forget all of the crap that's kind of coming at you from these different angles that create division that aren't actually who we are, I think, deep down.
And I mean, this is a very confronting issue, but I finished a period of being a co-director of the Centre for Countering Violent Extremism, because in addition to demography, I also look at extreme political events and movements. And I've spent quite a bit of time in the last couple of years in Europe, and I've been a visiting fellow at the Max Planck Institute in Germany. And they look at what happened in 2019 in Christchurch at the killings at the two mosques. And we all agree that was a horrific event. But what they were impressed by was how New Zealanders came together after that event and supported the Muslim community and reached out to the Muslim community and the Muslim community in reverse. And so I think you're right. I think Gabriel showed us yet again how we could come together and work together as communities, irrespective of your faith, irrespective of your political affiliation. You do it because you're New Zealanders, because your community is hurting in some way.
Yeah. And maybe we need
we should hold on to that.
Yeah, I think so, yeah, because I guess maybe we just need to get to that crisis point and it'll become a beautiful crisis where whatever it be, where we finally go, let's have some of these tough conversations and hey, we might go down the path of a capital gains tax, let's just say as an example.
Yes.
Well, it is what it is. Now we've that's been voted for and whatnot. Let's roll forward. I wonder if that's where referendums could be used more to engage more people in some of these things?
Yeah, I'm not a great fan of referendums because you still get the, if I've got 51% of the vote, I've won.
Gotcha.
But I am very much in favour of using new technologies for citizen engagement. So I don't think we get, you know, very often it's very difficult to reduce complex issues down to a simple question in which you answer yes or no.
Yeah.
And that's the problem with referendum. But if we talk about how can you and I, Luke and Paul, engage with a big meaty issue, we can get facts, we can disagree, but we can move towards a degree of agreement or consensus so that we actually get a decision. And even though I might not like what you've said or what you voted for, I can see the point. So, you know, we keep coming back to superannuation, but it's a good case in point. And that, I think, is what I took from the retirement commissioner. How can we get to a space where we put aside some of our political differences to talk about a central policy issue, which is superannuation, and we make a sensible decision about it, rather than divide up into political camps?
It sounded like you were encouraging people to act like adults. Maybe those days are gone, Paul. Yeah. Who knows?
Yeah, well, yeah. I do worry about some of the online discussion. I think that the social media is part of, you know, there's a lot of good that comes out of social media, and podcasts are one of them, Luke. But I do worry about some of the negative consequences, and I do think we need to address that. But let's have respectful discussions. Let's disagree respectfully. Let's talk about what's actually occurring and what the issues are, and then think about what we ought to do collectively to resolve them.
The thing that confuses me most about the geniuses online on social media that know everything, I'm like, okay, awesome. So please tell me, what are you doing to prepare?
Yes.
And then they don't reply. And I'm like, now I'm more confused because I felt like I was learning from a genius that knows everything that's going to happen. But then when you say to them, well, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
It just goes blank. You kind of think, well, don't waste all that time studying to get all that or get to that conclusion, then not go, right, well, what will I do to protect my future or be ready for retirement or whatnot?
And I just want to give a big shout out to politicians, particularly female and Māori politicians at the moment. The sort of vitriol that they experience online is really uncalled for. I mean, you know, these are people that are doing public service. I'm not talking about any particular party or individuals here, but, you know, they're doing public service. So let's engage with them. Let's put our point of view. You don't need to be nasty.
Yeah.
You don't need, you know, listen to what they have to say as well. And so when Luke says to you, well, what are you going to do? Let's have that conversation.
Mm.
I find it very frustrating.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah. Yes. Any of those roles would be horrific now in the public spotlight talking about these big issues because basically you're just about guaranteed that at least one in two people will disagree with you. And that's perfect for social media because it relies on an algorithm getting fed both sides of that to keep it going wider.
Yeah.
So if you've got positive, negative, and then it goes like this, then – but I just think, what it like just – go and do something. I don't know. Just don't get lost in those comments too long.
Yeah.
Hey, I just want to go back to the lunches for a second because, but I can see what I often try to do, or what I've tried to teach myself to do of a number of these things, instead of picking a massive side with them, whether it be capital gains or superannuation or whatnot, is I realize that it's very easy to get angry doing that. And one way to unwind that is to look at, like, almost go like a helicopter and fly above it and look down and go, oh, can I understand both sides of this? Mm-hmm. And so, case in point, those lunches that we provide for people in their schools and whatnot. And I've actually spoken to a school where they teach the kids how to cook, and and then they go off to university and they actually have those skills and stuff. And you go, wow, this is awesome. And then what I noticed as well is, but as the number of these lunches that we're providing for children and for kids was increasing, we were celebrating it. And I'm kind of like, the other part of me is thinking, I wonder if we shouldn't be celebrating the fact that we can't afford to feed our children, or may not be able to. And so then we're like, hey, look how many millions of lunches we've been able to provide for people. Yes. When maybe that's another example of, shit, things aren't going too good here if we're having to do this because people can't themselves. But obviously then I understand that it's really important that people are well nourished so that they it's easier to learn. So I completely get it. And I think, okay, I can see why it's a good investment into people, but then, again, and something like that becomes very confusing.
Yes. So for me, I will always ask for the evidence. So I suspect that, like a lot of policy programs in New Zealand, there's some things which we shouldn't be doing and there's some things we can do better. But I've also listened to the debates and I've listened to some of the people who are at the core of it, and I'm thinking, wow, as you said, why not get the kids to prepare the lunches, teach them nutrition, teach them budgeting, teach them whatever, skills about cooking? And I've heard some of that. So I think there's bits that we should then say, look, the evidence is that it's actually working, and it's working for these reasons. I don't think we should shy away from investigating anything, but then what we should do is we should gather that evidence, and we should make it available to as many people as are interested. And then we have that helicopter view. And then we say, right, you know, it's not ideological. It's not political. It appears to be working in this environment for these reasons. And over here, probably there's some wastage.
Yeah, I see.
So I'm a great one for evidence informing our thinking and our decision making.
Well, I guess that's what you've been doing for your entire life, right? Well, how long have you been looking for evidence and doing research?
40
like
odd
this?
Years. Wow. 40 odd years. But it's good. And to go back to something I said before, you know, I get to look at some of the terrible things that happen.
Yeah.
So violent extremism, but I also get to understand some of the very positive things.
Yeah. Okay, there's a couple of things that I had written down here that we haven't got to, but we've definitely gone into some tangents. But yes. I wanted to ask you briefly, how important is the census for New Zealand?
The census is huge because it covers all of us. Unfortunately, the sense, because of COVID and our distrust in government, or the distrust of some people in government, the census has struggled a wee bit recently, and that's partly because of what Stats New Zealand have been doing, but it's also partly what's happening in communities. But the census becomes the one time when we captured literally everybody in New Zealand and we asked them questions about who they are and what they do.
Yeah.
And so you can't understand a population and you can't plan without having something which encompasses literally everybody.
So that sort of information is not only important for Statistics New Zealand, who facilitate the collection of it, but for people like yourself and other people that may need to lean on that data so that you don't have to go out and try and build a sample size of it and things like that?
No, absolutely. Yeah. And so local government, national government, people who have responsibility for programs, nearly all of them rely on the census at some point.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I've written down here as well, I'm sure I've heard you say this or read this somewhere, that the Productivity Commission of New Zealand actually said we need to pause immigration. Is that right?
Well, Productivity Commission, which exists no longer, of course.
Yeah.
In 2022 did a very interesting, and I think one of their best, analyses of, in this case, immigration. And what they said was, these are the issues. We've not found any evidence for this. We have found evidence for this. These are some of the policy settings that we need to look at. And I think it's one of those moments when a, well, in this case, a quasi-government department. provided us with a good evidence about a major policy issue. And so I just am a bit sad that we won't see that anymore.
Yeah.
I understand why, but it still is one of those moments when a productivity commission, a major entity, looked at a major issue for the society and I think produced a great report. Unfortunately, we're in that part of the political cycle where the government at the time didn't really do very much about it. And it really wasn't picked up and it didn't really have much of an impact, unfortunately, on policy or politics in this country.
So just so I understand and people listening, we don't actually have a set out kind of plan of this is where New Zealand is going with...
No.
Yeah.
No, we don't. And what the Productivity Commission said was that we needed a GPS, a government policy statement. And the government policy statement would set out the issues and the options. And I noticed that now the current government are using GPS in this case and recently around transport. So I'm hoping that the notion of a GPS, a government policy statement, will be used in a whole lot of different sectors.
Yeah.
But yes, the Productivity Commission said we need this. The thing that I would go back to is that we have this very high immigration arrivals and net migration gain, and yet migration is only part of the total picture. Why aren't we talking about fertility, aging, regional differences alongside immigration?
Yeah, I see. Yeah. Because it's all too scary and too hard.
Yeah, and yeah. It's a big, complex, meaty issue.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. See, Canada does this much better. So provinces in Canada, regions in New Zealand, get to allocate 50% of the points required for a migrant to come to Canada and be approved. And so the provinces get to say, you know, we need this or we need that set of skills. We need people to come in and do this sort of work. So they get to play that, and we just don't do that in New Zealand. We don't think about provinces in that way, regions in that way. We don't think about them participating in this case in immigration in that sort of way.
Because I think you said earlier that 40% of Kiwis will move or live in Auckland. Is that right? By 2054-ish, around
earlier than that. Tangata Ohomairangi looked at New Zealand's population in 2038. So from a 2018 census basis, we looked out 20 years, and by 2038, 40% of New Zealanders are likely to live in Auckland.
Wow.
By the way, with the very high immigration rate of 2023, that might be a bit faster. Too late. It might be a bit faster. Sure. Yes.
I'm moving to the Mount, mate. What am I doing?
No, hang on a minute.
Okay.
So the overspill goes to Hamilton and Tauranga. Tauranga has all of the issues of a big city because it is growing really fast. And again, infrastructure is not keeping up with the population growth.
Well, I love the Chiefs.
pick somewhere else.
You just made my life harder, Paul. Yeah, I thought I had it figured out. Yeah. That's right, because they've got a massive rates issue there, don't they?
They do. Yeah. They do. And, of course, they've got commissioners who should be standing down mid this year, 2024. And it's going to be very interesting to see what happens there.
So I'm not very clued up with this, but that's basically where someone steps in to sort of run the council as such, because then we've lost trust in the people that are currently doing it?
Yes, well, the government lost trust in how Tauranga was being governed, and so they replaced the elected council with some commissioners.
Yeah.
And those commissioners, I think, have been doing quite a good job, by the way. So, but we need to revert to democratic process, and that's scheduled to occur this year.
Well, mate, fascinating conversation that has gone so quick. I know that we want to both dodge the Auckland traffic because the infrastructure hasn't kept up. So I'll let you get out of here. Yeah. But I guess a couple of things that I'm hearing and taking away from this, mate, is that Well, three things. One, we'll have to do this again at some stage because there'll be so much more ground to cover. But also for all of us not to really just bury our head in the sand around some of these big conversations and maybe start having some of them with our with our parents and with different generations and not coming at it from like a big, you know, angry angle, but just like exploring. Hey,
what's, you're wrong, I'm right.
And what's New Zealand going to look like? And the fact that there's a lot of information out there that basically projects, you know, where we're heading as a country. For some people, it just will not be a surprise to the likes of yourself.
And can I just acknowledge you, Luke, and this podcast? Because when you think about our public conversations and to some extent our media, there isn't enough opportunity, as far as I'm concerned, to have these sorts of conversations, to just have a conversation about what are really complex long-term issues.
Yeah, no worries. Well, I just think, you know, anyone that's dedicated 40 years of their life, you know, is going to know a shitload more than I am, that's for sure. And people listening, and I think people are really interested in this stuff, and it's, we dip our toe into it in the mainstream media and then we go, righto, we better, like, we can't go down there too far because otherwise, you know, we're going to get angry at each other for 72 hours talking about capital gains tax, and then we'll better find something else to talk about so that we, you know, don't get too serious about that convo. But really, these are all issues for everyday Kiwis to navigate over time because they're not going to go away.
No, absolutely.
Well, thank you for your time, and I'm sure we will talk again in the future. Thanks again, Paul.
Thank you, Luke.